just out of nowhere, a lady came up and said, "Are you Rabia?" It's weird to have like, and I have to say, to like white people can actually say your name, which is cool. Yeah.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I'm Akash.
I'm Arjun.
And today we are honored to have with us one of the biggest podcasters who's also South Asian. So we're doing it on two fronts. And you guys are all probably going to, if you listen to any podcast, you know who this woman is. We would like to welcome to the show Rabia Chowdhury.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And thank you for actually listening to a couple of episodes. You might be the only person. You might be the listener.
By the time I'm done with the other people, I'll have like three people listening to it.
Oh, yeah. Man. We got that exciting Rabia times. Bump coming, like the Stephen Colbert bump.
Three people.
I also do want to thank you for inviting us into where we are at this moment, which is the Institute, the U.S. Institute of Peace.
It is the USIP, U.S. Institute of Peace. And welcome to my cubbyhole. Yep.
It's a stunning building.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But before we were walking up, you were saying that you've only been here, that you were here for a year.
Yeah, I have a year-long fellowship here, and which in and of itself is kind of a miracle. It's really hard to get a fellowship in this place. So I'm really lucky to, you know, be working here. I'll be here for this whole year doing research, and then I'll probably bounce.
Can you tell me, fellowship, I understand in medical terms. Mm-hmm. I'm not as clear what it means in like for the legal education. Like what does that mean? Is it a grant? Is it a space where you have classes, or is it?
Nope. So the way the fellowship is structured here, and every institute's going to have different structures depending, and they'll have different fellowships. This is a research fellowship. So okay. What they did was they're like, we've got a big chunk of money. We want you to come up with a cool proposal around religion and CVE, which is countering violent extremism, and see what you got. And so about a year
say
ago.
Say that one more time. What was it?
Countering violent extremism, CVE.
Okay.
So, and all the work that USIP does is like mostly it's peace building work, but it's international work. So I put together a proposal about a year ago to study the intersection of violent extremism and religion in Pakistan, in southern Punjab, but also in Burma or in Sri Lanka, because there you have the phenomena of like Buddhist extremists who are like persecuting Muslim minorities. And then in Pakistan, it's like Muslim majority persecuting like Ahmadis and Shias and Hindus and other like small minorities. So we wanted to like look at both of those phenomenons.
That's fascinating. So that's what your work entails for
that's
this year.
1 year of research. Yeah, I'll be heading out to both places in the next few weeks.
You excited about that?
I'm excited, but I'm also, I mean, this is like really very, very complicated spaces. And the last thing you want to do is demonize people because of religion. So it's really hard. You want to really pull out like what are the religious aspects that are motivating people while preserving the faith, right? Like you don't want to.
So it's like a delicate.
It is delicate. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm excited, but I'm also like, I want to get it right.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons we wanted to talk with you is obviously you are a podcaster as well. I think it's always interesting to talk to fellow podcasters, but we would be remiss if we didn't just touch upon the case, Adnan Syed, the case and Serial. And I'm curious, actually, my first question is, what inspired you or how did the origin of Undisclosed come about?
Oh, so what happened was when Serial was like ongoing and it like exploded, I was writing about the case like every week because I would listen to Serial and I would say, well, okay, let me add some more information to that. But there were two other lawyers who I had never met before, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, and they had their own blogs and they started writing about the case. And people were sending me their articles like, oh, look what Susan wrote, look what Colin. And they were doing like these really deep investigations into the documents because I had made some of the documents public. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started, you know, I would share their blogs. I'd be like, oh my gosh, she discovered this and he analyzed this. And we had set up a legal trust at that point to collect money for Adnan. And the other trustee, it was me and one other lawyer who was volunteering, Dennis Robinson, who is now our executive producer, was like, listen, nobody's reading your blogs, right? Like basically nobody is reading your blogs. You're putting all this great information out. And I mean, really, and it's the kind of information that literally is probably going to lead to him getting a new trial, but nobody's hearing it. So he said, why don't you guys like put a podcast together? Because people are used to hearing this case through a podcast. And people are, and when Serial ended, people wanted more.
Right. Oh yeah. Oh
yeah. Yeah. They were like.
It was riveting.
They were clamoring for it. Yeah. So Undisclosed is not, you know, clamoring, a little riveting, that thing. But we were like, all right, we'll just. Because within 2 weeks, we just like slapped it together.
Yeah, basically. It wasn't riveting like, hey, this is fiction. It was riveting like, hey, here's a person's life. So anything about the case, people are emotionally invested in.
Yeah, but Sarah Koenig's an amazing storyteller.
For sure.
We're like three lawyers who are like, and in Strickland versus Myers, blah, 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 like we're like talking about legal. So it's different, but still our listenership has been pretty tremendous. And I think it's because people just love the case.
I think that it sounds like the narrative form of Serial and like the emotional investment that people got would then carry through some of that legalese to allow.
We couldn't have done this alone. Like you couldn't have done like an undisclosed without the Serial. Like right. we had to have the Serial.
Right. Yeah. What had you done a podcast before? I mean, you what were the challenges? What were the was that a whole other thing for you?
No, we didn't know. I mean, I think when Dennis first proposed it, we just can't. First of all, we didn't have the capacity. We're all like, you know, three full-time attorneys and professionals, and we didn't know anything about like how to do it, like how to tape it. We're all in three different spaces. You know, Colin is like in South Carolina, and so it was very challenging. And our first couple episodes sound like it. They sound right. Really bad. And we had a volunteer do the website. We had a volunteer come up with our logo. We had a couple people volunteer to do the sound editing. And the night or like when we, after we taped the episode, our first episode, and it was supposed to like drop that Monday, on that Friday, our volunteer editor was like, I can't do it. Like I'm sick or something. And we were like, oh my God, we're going to die. So I learned GarageBand like overnight. And I did the editing the first time. And it was a disaster. It was bad. Right. And the problem with that was that the media had started
ripping. Well, you also guys introduced a lot of, you guys make it, you guys have music underneath. There's like clips that you're adding into it and stuff. It is a heavily editing required.
It does, yeah. So we had music and I'm like, how do you lay tracks? I was trying to lay, it was so bad. And the problem was like, it had been already, like the media had been waiting for 2 weeks for it to launch because Rolling Stone covered this new podcast is going to, like Serial Part 2. Right. So like I think 2 million people downloaded the first episode and they were like, oh, that sucked.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't Serial. We got really bad reviews online.
Our podcast doesn't have nearly as much editing as yours, and we still mess up. But the beauty is no one listens. So it's like the tree that fell in the woods.
Only your mom. Heard. Only your mom knows, right?
Have you seen my mom commenting on every Facebook post?
I haven't seen it. Yeah,
see it.
Have you been surprised, or what has been the most surprising thing about the power of the influence of podcasting? What was that? Were you understanding that already? Did you have a glimpse of that because of Serial, and then you were like, yes, let's take advantage of this? Or was Dennis really the one that was driving that?
I think Dennis is the one who had the vision, and we didn't really understand what this could do until it just started happening on its own. We were, and the three of us as lawyers, I mean, we were so focused on the details of the case, what we wanted to tell the public. We weren't thinking so much about like how it was impacting like the public discourse and even the case itself. It was all volunteer, but I think after the first couple episodes, you know, we were contacted by advertisers. So we're like, first we were like, should we do that? Should we get out? And I'm like, you know what? If we get advertising, we can actually put the money into the legal fund. And that's what we did. And, you know, we raised almost $200,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And that in 1 year of revenue for Adnan's legal. So it's like paid for his legal bills, really.
That's incredible. Wow.
And then there was stuff in the podcast that helped lead to, and, you know, we were working also with Justin, his actual attorney. And so there was stuff that was.
Is that a difficult thing to navigate? The
Yeah.
How much Justin might say, hey.
I mean, Justin is like going to be a typical attorney. And we're all attorneys, so we get it. But Justin's like, say nothing. Tell nobody anything. And but what we understand that there are certain things that you can present in court and it still won't fly. It's amazing how hard it is to overcome like a conviction, right? You can say, look, we have DNA evidence pointing to somebody else. And you still might not get any. But it's different to get public support.
Right.
So there was always a balance of, listen, Justin, we're going to talk about this. We found this. We're going to talk about this. And then he might say, well, can you just wait till here? Or can you just do it like this? And there's certain things where everybody agreed. And even now there are things that we haven't made public because we're like, it's not the right time. We have to wait. I mean, we're lawyers.
So you've been
in
contact with him.
Oh yeah. We work together on these things. I mean, like he used Susan and Colin all throughout the appeal hearing last 2 months ago as resources. Like they helped pull the evidence and documents and we work closely with him.
You brought up getting ad money, and that kind of brings up, I guess, a two-part question. Number one, this podcast has afforded you a certain level of fame, I guess, for lack of a better word. For example, Arjun's sister really wants to meet you.
Oh, that's sweet.
What's that been like?
I mean, it's...
Do you feel that?
Sometimes, like, I had a meeting, a lunch meeting at a local restaurant that everybody loves, Founding Farmers, and just out of nowhere, a lady came up and said, "Are you Rabia?" It's weird to have, like, and I have to say, do like white people can actually say your name, which is cool. Yeah. So it's interesting. Like, I've gotten used to it now. Like, you know, it's not overwhelming. It doesn't happen all the time. I, you know, but every so often, like this lady coming up, and so we took I took a picture with her. It does happen, and I appreciate it. We need the publicity, honestly. In For me, it comes down to like Adnan's case. I don't want people to forget Adnan. He's still in prison.
Which is exactly what right. My second part of the question is going to be. You take the ad money, you put it directly back into the case. You don't get any profit from it. Yeah. Your Twitter handle doesn't. You're not like. It doesn't seem like you're pimping it out on your podcast. It's like your personal thing.
Yeah.
Is that really important? Like, talk about why that's important to you, I guess. Or
we were just noticing that you've the integrity of to not. Exploit this opportunity to like build upon your own sort of, and I don't know, you could have turned into like the food babe or something, you know what I mean, like the legal something, you know what I mean, you could have turned it into something.
Yeah.
And you, is that been a conscious choice not to, or is that just something you have no interest in? Or
no, what? I mean, look, there for Susan, Colin and I, it was always a conscious choice that we were like really just deeply, I mean, for me it's a personal
right
connection to the case. It's all about Adnan. I mean, my thing is I didn't care about Sarah. I didn't care even what Sarah Koenig was going to produce. I had no idea what it was going to look like at the end of her investigation. I didn't care if she did a show or she didn't do a show.
Right.
What I wanted was a reporter's investigative lens and her ability to talk to people and get people to talk.
Mm.
And I thought maybe Sarah would be the one to find the evidence that could exonerate him.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care what she did with the show or the publicity. Right. And even, but now I realize that, you know what, after Serial ended, we needed the public attention to fundraise. We needed the public attention to move the stuff in court. So that is the most important thing. If that doesn't work, none of this matters. None of it matters. Having said that, though, you know, all of the money from the last year has gone to Adnan's fund, but we're done talking about Adnan's case, basically. And we're actually moving on to a second wrongful conviction, which...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. It's another really... I mean, there's so many of these stories.
Right.
So many stories. People who've been like, this other kid, he's been locked up. I think it's been 17 years for him, too. And we are positive he's completely innocent. So, and the Innocence Project actually came to us with a case and said, listen,
wow.
Can you do this? Because we have hit a wall.
Were your eyes more open to this issue because of Adnan?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like, I've never been an advocate on these issues, right? I don't do wrongful conviction work. I'm not a criminal attorney.
Right.
But obviously this is, we got so many emails, like hundreds of emails saying, can you look at our case? Can you look at our case?
Wow.
So, we can't do all of them, but we do have a second season that's launching in June. Amazing. I'm sorry, July. And now we are, incorporated as a private entity. So it is going to be a business model where all the work we're going to put in, we're actually going to get like, you know, some profit sharing.
Scheme. Are you concerned about, you had said that, you know, you couldn't have Undisclosed without the Serial. Are you concerned about with this next case, how to integrate?
Yeah.
How are you guys figuring that out? Or you?
No, we thought about that. We're like, we don't have the Serial jump this time, right? Like, right. Are people really going to be interested in this guy's story? So we are very cognizant of the fact that we have to create a really good narrative first.
Mm-hmm.
We have to tell his story before we can get into the deep dive into his documents and mm-hmm. the case. I don't know how well we're going to do it, but hopefully our listeners will be patient with us and let us figure it out.
Guys, the 15 of you that are going to move from us to season 2 of Undisclosed, be patient. Be patient with Akash.
Yeah.
So be patient in this.
Patient with me? What are you talking about? I'm a goddamn gentleman right now. Legs crossed. Killing it.
He does have his leg. Actually, they both do. All of us
have our
legs. We're so proper.
We are. Let's.
We should sit Indian style on the floor. Wouldn't that be like more appropriate for us?
I actually am really embarrassed that I can't sit Indian style. Like,
what?
I have really bad hip
flexors. I don't even understand what that means.
Cross-legged?
No.
You don't understand what that means?
I didn't understand that. How you can't was what I meant by that.
Well, there's
two ways to do the desis. You can do the cross-legged mm-hmm. sit, but there's also, at least in Pakistan, I know it exists, the squat, right?
That's even harder. That's a
the squat's even harder.
It's tough for me, but I can still do it.
You can do the squat. I can't. Like on the flat heels, I can't.
I can get pretty close, but I can't dive from it. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was learning how to swim, they were like, yeah, you squat and then you like die from it. But like when I'm squat, I'm so lean back that I can't like move.
Well, I can't swim, so.
I think we're good in chairs. I think we'll
stick with chairs and forks and stuff. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Let's move away from the case for a little bit. I did want to introduce this, and I'm not sure if there's a more sensitive way to do this, so I apologize ahead of time. But okay. We haven't had the honor and pleasure of interviewing someone that wears a hijab.
Okay.
And I was curious, we wanted to explore that and, okay. and talk about that.
What would you like to know? What lies beneath the veil? Is that what it is?
Well, actually, you said you didn't always do it. I didn't.
So what sparked the change?
Look, you know, my family is from Pakistan. I'm from Lahore. Like, so we grew up in a very, like, a South Asian, a typical South
Asian. And you
were born there. I was born in Lahore. Yeah. We grew up in a very typical South Asian family where it was like, you're just rocking the Shalwar Kameez and the Saris and whatever. And it wasn't about the hijab. Like, that was, to us, it was like an Arab thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I was, you know, I had gotten married, I had gotten divorced, I was a single parent, and I was living alone with me and my daughter. She was like 6 at the time. And at that point, I realized I had become more religious to the extent that I was just doing a lot. And this was after 9/11, where a lot of shit was hitting the fan. So
right.
we were trying, as a Muslim, I was trying to figure out like what's really going on, like where are certain things coming from, what's in our religion. So I started like just doing more self-study. And at some point I realized, oh, you know, it actually, hijab is actually an obligation in the faith. And even that wasn't enough for me to like really do it. But what happened was I was sending my daughter to an Islamic school only because my Arabic's really poor. Mm-hmm. I couldn't teach her like how to read the scripture and stuff very well. And I thought, you know what? I'll just like outsource it. They can take care of that.
Was this like an immersion school? Like would they have, or was this...
It's not immersion. There's a bunch of private Islamic schools around.
Oh, wow.
They're everywhere actually. But and I've actually asked Hindu friends. I'm like, are there like private Hindu schools? I don't think there are. But
no. We have like, the only thing I can relate to is like temple Sunday schools. That's right, the only thing that I could
but like that's expand that into like specific. 5 days a week.
Right. Yeah. But they also do all the other education.
Curriculum. It's
right.
the county curriculum, and usually they'll add Quran, which is like reading the scripture, knowing mm-hmm. how to read the Arabic. And then they'll have like Islamic studies, which is like a, like history, basically Islamic history. And
oh, that's great.
Yeah. So it'll have like two or three extra components.
Are there ever yeah. any non-Muslim kids being sent here? Because I know in like the, you know, Germanish immersion, they'll have kids that aren't of German yeah. descent in there. Does
my Indian friend took a Japanese immersion school.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds pretty cool. No, I've seen in a couple of schools, and I've lived in Connecticut, I've lived all around the Beltway here, so my daughters have been in different Islam schools, and some of them you do see one or two, but it's very rare.
Okay.
And especially after 9/11, it's going to be more rare. But it does happen because in certain places, like the county I live in, the education is not so great, so, mm-hmm. you know, the private schools are more... I mean, they're just like more parents want to send their kids to private school, and Islamic schools are not as expensive as like Catholic okay. schools and other schools and stuff. Right. So yeah, it happens sometimes. But anyway, so, you know, I was sending her to Islamic school, and she would like her uniform had a little hijab with it, a little white hijab. So she was like in kindergarten, she'd wear hijab, and she'd come home and she'd take it off, and I never wore it. And so one day I was just like casually, I was like, you look so cute in your scarf. Are you going to wear it when you grow up? She's like, no, you don't wear it. Why am I going to wear it? And I was like, crap. Like, I'm giving her all these mixed signals,
right?
So, and I used to work at Health and Human Services in the legal counsel's office here. And I was like, this is going to be really weird, but I'm just going to like out of the blue show up wearing a scarf one day. And I did, and it worked out. So it's been 10 years now.
Were you nervous about that first day when you were you expecting?
You know what? When you work with a group of lawyers, because they know, like, they can't be discriminatory. Everybody's right. pretending like they didn't see anything. Like, nobody said a word. They're just like, I was looking around. I wasn't nervous. I was just like, let's just see how this goes. And I also, it did an increment. So I would, like, wear it during the workday so my colleagues could get used to it. But then I wouldn't wear it on weekends when I was kicking it with my friends. And then I wouldn't still wear it to, like, functions and weddings and events. And it took a couple years for me to be, like, all right, I'm in it 100%. And, you know, there are days when I'm like, that's it, I'm not wearing it. I'm done.
Is your friend circle a lot of South Asian people? And if not, were they receptive to it slowly or quickly? Or
Yeah, most of my friends are South Asian and, like, across the spectrum. And the weird thing is, like, some of my closest friends are actually South Indian, Tamil, Brahmin,
right.
Hindu.
Oh, yeah.
And they were, like, really supportive. But my Muslim friends were actually not so supportive.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe triggered an insecurity.
Why?
First of all, none of them were that observant. And I remember one of my friends, she doesn't wear hijab. And she said, Robbie, why are you going to do this? You only live once. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's the point. Like, I'm thinking I only live once. I'm going to do it, like, you know, as best I can. I think it just made them uncomfortable. And there is a phenomenon, and I'm sure it happens in all kinds of communities, where people who are not as observant feel like people who at least look observant, like shame them, you know, make them feel like.
It's a projection.
Right, it's a projection sometimes. Yeah. And I could sense that. I was like, look, just because I'm wearing it, I'm not judging you for not wearing it now. So we all got over it.
I have two questions for you. Again, my ignorance. Can you walk me through what the thought process behind the hijab is okay. in the Quran.
Well, I mean, like, the Quran has a couple of reasons specifically for it. One of them is specifically so you are identified as a Muslim woman.
Mm.
So, like, okay. when people see you, they're like, that's a Muslim woman. Like, you know, like, basically don't mess with that. Like, give her some respect and honor. And it's really to kind of elevate the status of Muslim women. But the thing is that people don't realize that it's not, like, a new thing. It's a continuation of Judeo-Christian tradition. Hmm. So Jewish women, oh. yeah, Orthodox Jewish women.
Oh, Orthodox Jewish, yes.
Cover their hair. Right. And they wear, like, and hello, you know, Catholic nuns. And, like, you know, my mom would always say to women to people when they'd ask her, she'd be like, have you ever seen, like, an image of the Virgin Mary without a hijab? You have never seen the Virgin Mary, like, in any depiction, just hanging out with her hair. Like, she's always covered. And it's a tradition that's always existed. And it exists even in Hindu cultures where it's, you know, a lot of women cover their head, you know. Mm. But if you want to go in deeper, I think it does go to issues of modesty. And so, like, a woman's hair being kind of her, like, crowning glory. But for most women, especially in the West, I think Muslim women in the West, it's really just about identity. It's like, I identify as a Muslim woman. I want you to identify me as a Muslim.
Mm.
And it really, really impacts the dynamics between people. It's interesting.
Before we get to the dynamics of how it impacts, you know, between people, I'm curious, how has it affected your relationship either with your faith or your own identity?
I don't know. You know, the thing is, like, to me, it's not really connected directly to, like, my faith. Like, my faith fluctuates. There'll be, like, weeks when I'm like, oh my God, I haven't prayed in, like, 6 days. Like weeks will go by and I'm like, oh my God, like, I'm not even thinking. I just put it on and it's like a robot and I'm thinking about it. And that's bad. You shouldn't do that.
Is that bad, or is that actually part of the freedom of, like, it acting on you regardless? I don't know. I'm just trying to be compassionate.
I don't know. No, you are. You're being very compassionate. I'm ignorant.
Yes, this is true.
I'm joking.
I'm happy to be both of those things. Should is such a trigger word for me.
Should it?
Well, should.
Yeah,
should
I see what you're saying.
It just becomes a very trigger word for me.
No, the should is me internalizing it, right? Like, I feel like...
Sure, which is, to me, a lack of compassion for your own self.
Yeah. No, I get that.
Arjun's really good about not letting you be too hard on yourself, and then he's nice. Stupid hard on himself.
Oh, so really?
That's how it goes.
I'm practicing.
It's a projection.
I don't know
if I used that right. I just heard it earlier.
But that's a very compassionate nature, though. Like, yeah, it's very sweet.
No, thank you. I try.
All
right, we're off track here. Wait. I want to go back. You're talking about your relationship for yourself and your faith. So you said it wasn't about faith as much because your faith fluctuates.
It was about faith when I started wearing it.
Right.
But after that, because the thing is, like, it's just what I know it's all in my head. For me, it's like, if I didn't pray for 3 days and I'm going to wear the scarf and I'm go out, people are going to project on me like, oh, she's like a really, like, pious person. I'll be at a stoplight telling people to F off, like, literally, and I do it on Twitter too. And so there is a bit of a dissonance sometimes between, like, what people think I am based on what I look like. And I'm like, am I projecting who I really am? Because today I just feel like cursing people out and just being a shithead versus, you know, conforming to. And I've had people reach out to me and say, hey, you wear a hijab, you represent Muslims. Like, you shouldn't talk like that in public. You shouldn't act like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
I won't accept that. I'm going to
accept
like
that responsibility.
No, I'm going to act like how I'm going to act. And we're all human. And, you know, Muslims screw up too. And everybody screws up. And we're all trying to improve ourselves. But I mean, for me, look, the hijab is not even secondary. It's like tertiary. It's like me wearing it or not wearing it is like, I don't think that has, I think it has nothing to do with, like, what I am as a how good of a human being I am.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with it. It's just how I want to identify. It's like, maybe it's like when people get a tattoo. Like, it's just something like an identity thing, right? I feel empowered by it. So
there you go, though. But you feel empowered by it. Mm-hmm. That's something that's a tangible shift.
That is, yeah, definitely. And I'll tell you why, especially because when you work in a legal environment as a woman, I mean, when you work in a lot of different environments as a woman, there's a lot of sexism that comes your way. And when I was a young attorney and I had mostly uncle clients and uncles I was working with, right? I mean, like, I would get it all the time in my 20s. I'm 41 now, but in my 20s, I mean, it was really uncomfortable all the time. But as soon as I wore the hijab, I just became like
too pious.
Like Miss Rabia instead of, you know, yeah. Hey, I became like this object that they had to like give me a measure of respect. They couldn't mess with me. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah. In a way it was kind of weird because I became almost like asexual. I talk about that where guys used to hit on me and like all of a sudden nobody's like, oh, we don't even see her anymore, which is also kind of sucks sometimes, but it is what it is. That's fine. Working environment is easier.
And your daughter, is it one daughter, two daughters?
I have two daughters. One is 7 and one is 19, almost 19.
Are they, are you letting them make the decision with the hijab entirely?
So my older daughter, who is from my first marriage, her father's family is kind of, they're all over the place. They're like kind of, some of them are secular, some are religious. And her father never liked it when she would wear the scarf with her like school uniform. And I told her, I've always told her, I said, listen, be a good person. Be conscious of God. You can wear the scarf if you want, or you don't have to wear it. So when she moved out to go to college last year, she came home for the first couple of weekends and she wasn't wearing her scarf. And I was like, okay, that's cool. And I didn't say anything. And then third weekend she came home and she was. I actually picked her up actually the third weekend from college and she was wearing it. And I'm like, why are you wearing it? Like, what happened? She's like, I don't know. I just felt like wearing it. But she said after 2 weeks of not, and then showing up the third week with it on, like nobody realized it was the same person. Hmm. I was like, didn't people say that's so weird? Why'd you suddenly? So, but I've told her it's totally her choice. I said, I don't care one way or the other. I made the choice. She can make the choice.
You, I've noticed that you say scarf versus hijab. Is there a different, is that just a colloquial?
It's a language thing. I mean, like hijab is the Arabic, but hijab has a much broader meaning.
Okay.
A scarf is something specific, right? Hijab is something that even men can do. Hijab means something that is modest. So you can be wearing a scarf and be totally immodest, right?
Okay.
You can be vulgar, you can be immodest, you can be flirty, you can be suggestive, you can be all kinds of things.
That's a really important distinction. So it would be more,
So do you call it a scarf because you don't feel like you live as modestly, I guess you say, to like cuss people out at the stoplight, this and that?
Sometimes I don't cuss them out every day, but
is that a thing you do? Like,
DC traffic, I'm amazed that you don't.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Some crazy. There's just people are very aggressive and not really thinking about.
People are tired. People are tired, but it's not. Come on, New York is much worse.
I don't drive in New York.
Oh, then.
But LA is the worst.
Okay, still. Maybe LA is the worst. Yeah. I mean, it's for me like it is a piece of fabric at the end of the day, and I'll be honest. I want, and I'm having the conversation with you guys. But I don't like, I just want it to be like me wearing a shirt. Like, why would I have a conversation about like, why'd you wear that shirt? Why are the sleeves long? Why is it loose? Why is it, right. You know, where I
think it's because of the consistency.
What do you mean?
It's because it's something that's always.
There. Oh, what's part of me?
Yeah.
Like if you always wore sweatpants.
Then I think that there, then
like
I would
religiously wore sweatpants.
Yeah. I've never seen you in shorts, man. What is
What's that about? I think that that's where the interest comes from me because that's a very different choice. Yeah. You know, like
it's more unique than.
You know, definitely. Yeah. But the thing is, like, so there's so much that, and I think it's just how women are treated. Look, you have somebody like Hillary Clinton, who, if she dresses one way one day, or has her hair done one way, or should make a, like, people are so obsessed with women how they're dressed. I mean, when I in the Muslim community, if I'm wearing a scarf and I'm wearing like skinny jeans with it, right, you're gonna get called out. Oh, you're immodest. You're like disrespecting the scarf. So it's almost like, okay, then you want me to just take it off? Like, I just want people to stop. Like, let us women wear whatever the fuck they want to wear. Just let us wear, dress how they want to dress and get on with your lives is what I feel like saying. So I just, that's why I'm like, whether my daughter wears it, doesn't wear it, tomorrow I decide I'm not going to wear it, I'm going to show up like in a miniskirt. That is totally my choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd love to move away from this, and you've mentioned your first marriage. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear about whether was he Muslim as well? Was that important to you when you were considering your partner?
So I met him in college, and he was a foreign student from Pakistan. But I mean, his family was like in the Middle East, like in Sharjah, whatever. But anyway, he was doing his master's in the U.S., and I met him, and I wasn't thinking that he's like Muslim or this and that. I was a teenager who fell in love.
Right.
And after 3 years of fighting with the parents, we finally got married. My mother was not happy about their family. She didn't like them very much. You know, mother's instinct. Yeah. So it was five like really rough years with his family, and they were very traditional. I mean, the funny thing was like they weren't religious, but they were traditional in the sense that it's like a joint family system. Mm-hmm. And like I was the oldest daughter-in-law, so I had like roles and duties that they expected me to fulfill. I mean, yeah,
it's traditions that benefits their family a lot more than yours. So of course. It's easy to be traditional.
Right. And it was an abusive marriage. There was physical abuse and emotional abuse. And I was in law school at the time. It was just a really... it's one of those things where it's like when you fight your family to get married and you're like, crap, I can't tell them now like what's really happening. Oh, so, God. Yeah. But after 5 years, you know, I had graduated law school and things kind of unraveled quickly. And I'm glad they did. And I got out. So.
And you are married again, as we can see by the giant rock on your finger.
It's not giant.
You are wearing undisclosed.
You're talking to a comedian and an actor who is only now getting some money. So
okay.
That is...
I swear, it's like...
He spent as much on that as Adnan just got in legal fees from undisclosed.
I promise.
I'm pretty certain. But...
I advise you never to go into the jewelry business, because honestly... when he bought me this ring, my current husband, who we've been married 10 years, was a total broke. He's 5 years younger than me. I was that cougar.
Get it, girl.
Yeah, I did. And he.
Wait a minute. Are we not? You were. If I'm doing math right, you were 31. And
I was 31.
Calling yourself a cougar.
I mean, okay. Look, in our community, you're 31, single mother, right? And I'm going. And there's like this 26-year-old strapping, never been married. Desi guy, you know, can you imagine his family? Like, yeah, they heard, like, oh
my
god.
My question is, how was that received by your family, his family?
Well, he
also had, is he
your
Muslim?
Daughter?
He's Muslim, he's yep. Muslim. And actually, the second time I wanted to get remarried, I was actually focused on that. I had started wearing the scarf, and I was like, you know what, I actually want a Muslim, because with my first marriage, like. In a Muslim marriage, like, a woman has certain rights, right? Like, and even to the extent of, like, a man has to give her, like, a nice sizable dowry, and it's called the mahar. And my ex-husband was like, I'm not giving you a dime, just get out. And so I was like, if I marry a guy who's, like, actually religiously conscious, he'll fulfill my rights better. Mm-hmm. Like, so that's what I thought. But anyhow, I met this guy, and for 3 years he pursued me, and I wasn't ready to get remarried. And then when I finally said, okay, I think I'm ready, I was like, you got to talk to your family. Because they're going to flip out. I'm like a divorced woman with a kid. And I was like, and then they have to talk to my family. I said, if everybody agrees, like, we'll go through with it. If not,
oh, this is amazing.
Yeah. I was like, if not, I'm not doing it. So he went and talked to his mom, and, his mom is like an angel. Like, she's one of the most amazing human beings I've met in my life. And she said, you know, let me think about it. And after a month, she said to him, give me, her family's phone number. I want to talk to them. So she talked to my mom, and she said, you know, we're just coming. We're just going to come in a week. So they came, like, in a week. A week later, like, they came with, like, two huge vans from Toronto, like, just full of, like, 20 people in two vans.
Wow. Yeah, Canadians. I'm going to tell you something about Canadians.
They're nice people.
They're good people.
Yeah, they're good people. It was really amazing. They came. They brought a ring. Actually, it wasn't this ring. They brought a different ring. And they brought, like, you know, flowers and the sweets and all that stuff. And they're like, we're not here to meet her. We're just making this for real. So,
oh wow,
we got engaged on the spot with like all these people. And
wow,
I mean, did you guys date for a while, or was it he was just kind of courting you and you were kind of whatever? And then, like, how quickly did it move?
So, no, it was 3 years. We knew each other, and there was not really dating involved because he was in Toronto and I was here.
Mm. Okay, but you were building. You were building some form of
relationship.
Well,
we had a relationship. Yeah. I mean, we talked all the time. In the beginning, I was more like it was like the courting. Like, we were friends. He was interested in me. But I just wasn't mentally ready, emotionally ready to get remarried. And then suddenly one day it clicked, and I said, you know what? I think it's been 4 years. I've been divorced. I'm good. We can get remarried.
Let me ask you a question. Going back, you were coming out of an abusive relationship. Was there ever a moment where you became disillusioned with Islam? Or were you able to separate the cultural aspect and the
religion? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Was that easy to do? Because I imagine... I don't know, you know what I mean? I imagine that
it was easy for me to do because my ex-husband was so secular.
Yeah, he wasn't religious. It was a traditional family, not religious.
Right.
Yeah, he was so secular. And like his family, like, once in a while, I remember going to a wedding. They didn't drink regularly, but, you know, he's like, he would have a social drink sometimes. And I came from a family where nobody ever drank because it's like such a big deal. Like, religiously, you don't, like, Muslims don't drink. So they were so, he was so secular that I didn't connect to that. And my family is moderately religious, and there was never any abuse in my home, and, you know, right. So I didn't connect the two. I didn't conflate the two.
Now, can I ask you this, to speak to some of these things that you said, like, in Islam, Women are afforded certain rights. Yeah. A lot of people have a different perception of Islam.
Right.
Can you just speak to some of those things to enlighten people?
Well, yeah, people have a terrible misconception. And you know what? They're legitimately so, because Muslim men, like men all over the world, you know, will treat women really badly. I mean, the rates of domestic violence in Muslim communities is just as high as anywhere else, right? The difference is it just becomes sanctioned by religion. So, my mother-in-law, who is, like I said, an angel, like she once said, she's like, you know, Islam is a great religion, but Muslims are the worst people. she's like, because they basically don't take anything that they've been taught and like implement it. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's absolute, I'm not going to be apologetic. I mean, like, the conditions of women in Muslim majority countries is abhorrent, mostly. And, you know, it's interesting, there are scholars, like major Muslim scholars, who have said, listen, a Muslim woman has so much more protection, like in a non-Muslim country. Like I can walk down the street dressed however I want, and I'm going to be okay. But you know how it is back home for women. Like, you can't do that. Like, you're going to be, no matter how covered you are, you're going to be harassed. You could be, you know, you could be abducted. I was abducted once, you know, for like in Pakistan for 12 hours until the guy finally dropped me off at home.
Oh my, I mean, God.
It's a terrifying situation. It's another long story.
We're just going to drop that for part two. That's a tease for part two.
That's like a whole story. But the point is, like, it was only because this guy was a military driver. Wow.
The guy that abducted
me. Because my uncle was a colonel in the military, and so I was just with him for the day. God. And here, you're getting a cab. You say hello. You have a conversation over there. If you get a little bit too free, they're like, "Oh, this chick is gonna roll." You know what I mean? He just took off with me. He took off like into the mountains with me. It was crazy. You know, I'm blessed that nothing happened. And he finally, after like me just losing it and, you know, threatening, and he finally dropped me back off at home. But the point I'm making is that, that we have a long way to go in a lot of Muslim majority countries in terms of codifying women's rights. And, you know, there's a reason people have those ideas about Muslims, because they don't treat the women the way the religion says they should. That's the problem.
How often do you go back to Pakistan?
I've been going back more frequently, every like a couple of years. I was actually there this winter. I was there for a whole month. It was awesome. I loved it. I'm going back. And that was like, I had some work, but I was mostly like family weddings and shopping. And I took my daughters. And so we did like a whole sightseeing, all of it. And I'll be going next month, though, just for like a week.
For work.
Yeah, for work. So
how important is it for you to take your daughters back?
Oh, it's really important. I want them to really embrace like their, you know, multicultural identity and take the best from everything. Where I'm also like a totally proud American patriot. I am that goober. So my daughters, my daughters went to Islamic school. In Islamic school, they don't teach you the Pledge of Allegiance or like, you know, the Star Spangled Banner. And I did. I'm like, no, you know, but I want them to be equally as proud of their, you know, ethnic heritage.
When you, I've seen some remarkable photos of Lahore in like the 50s, and it's just like this amazing, almost like, it imagine like Harlem within the Renaissance, that kind of space. Is it possible to go back to that, or is that just a lost age?
Oh God,
I don't know if that's a fair question, but I saw those photos, and I, in my ignorance, was like, whoa,
yeah.
Because the image that I have of Pakistan, and even of India at this point, you know, is so powerful that, like,
right.
I mean, that was such a, and it wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. Things have changed tremendously. I mean, I'll give you an example. My father, when we came to this country, it was because my father's best friend helped to sponsor him.
Mm-hmm.
And his best friend is a Pakistani Christian.
Mm.
Now, they were that, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't like the kind of religious tensions that exist now, like the extreme level of intolerance that is happening like now, didn't exist then. It just didn't. So there was certainly a very different feeling in Pakistan then, and I'm not saying this from me, because I've not grown up there, but everybody I've spoken to, from people in civil society to just people in households, they're like, it's a different country. It's gotten much, people live there. I mean, there's still wonderful, wonderful people there. But yeah, it's just, it's, is not embodying the dream that Pakistan should have been, basically, for its minorities. And that's a big shame. And they're being held hostage by, like, religious nuts, which is actually happening in a lot of different countries in the world. Yeah. And, like, in Israel, the right-wingers are holding a here, mm-hmm. the Tea Party. I mean, so there is, like, this increasing intolerance and polarization, like, all over the world, I think.
But it's, to me, I think there's, maybe this is me being really optimistic, but the fact that it's shifted so quickly just goes to prove that it was taught. That it was something, it's not inherent, no. Which means that it can be changed again.
I mean, I hope so. See, like in Pakistan, and you've seen this across the Muslim world, there was a Wahhabization. Like there was a Saudi-funded, like, you know, the religion you're going to see. So you have like this indigenous kind of a Sufi culture that existed that was very egalitarian. Mm-hmm. Not always completely, but mostly. And then in the like 70s, 80s, 90s, there was a ton of funding and like publications that came from Saudi Arabia that just brought in a very different kind of flavor of Islam. And so Islam in Saudi Arabia looks very different than Islam, like let's say in Kenya or where in a matriarchal society, or Islam in Indonesia, which is very different. And Islam in Pakistan didn't look like it does today. And can it go back? It's going to be hard, especially given like all the external factors, the war on terror, the rise of violent extremist groups. There's a lot happening right now that's making it hard.
Does that make it complicated then when exposing the next generation to Pakistan as it is now versus the Pakistan that you would want it to be, or the Pakistan that you could almost, I wonder if there was a way, and this is where I think about our role as, you know, first generation, second generation, third generation, you know, South Asians in this country. Can we not create that here?
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you are a Muslim in America right now and you're raising children, you have to take a step back and tell your kids that this was not the America I was raised in.
It's not just
Pakistan. This is a problem. Yeah. When my teenager and my seven-year-old see Trump, you know, think about, should we put Muslims in internment camps?
Right.
Like, people are having the kinds of conversations you expect, like, Nazis and fascists to have, right? And so it's not just that I have to explain that Pakistan wasn't like this. Although when they go back to Pakistan, they're with family. They're not seeing this, obviously.
Right.
But I have, for them, this reality is much more challenging of an America that is like demonizing them day and night publicly, that GOP candidates can say anything they want with impunity. And, you know, there are poll after political poll that show like up to 70% of GOP voters think Muslims should be banned from this country. Like that is much more complicated. Like, how do I tell my daughters, no, you belong here. Like, you have a right to be here.
Are they having those kind of conversations with you? I mean, I'm assuming that the 19-year-old is more aware of this stuff than the 7-year-old.
Yeah. You know,
or hope at least.
Well, that is one reason that I like always put them in Islamic school. I just didn't want them to be bullied in school. That's happening a lot. A lot of Muslim kids are getting bullied in schools.
Right.
And I just wanted them to just really build a really strong like Muslim, be proud of being Muslim without being harassed about it.
Right.
But now that she's in college, and she's grown up seeing me talk about this stuff, right? For 15 years, I've been an advocate on these issues. And, you know, she's involved in the student government. She's involved in the Muslim Student Association. So I think she's taking these things head on. And I've talked to her a lot about it. And we have a very diverse social, like, you know, life. My closest friends are like, you know, my dad's best friend, who's Pakistani Christian, his daughter's my best friend. She's Pakistani Christian, you know, and I have my Hindu friends. I have Buddhist friends. Like, so she knows that what is being said is not the reality.
Right. So that communication is important. I think we're running low on time for here.
Yeah.
I want to ask, definitely would love if you have time in the future to do a part two, because that story sounds crazy. But I would love Undisclosed is coming out in July.
The new season with a new case. Yeah.
What else are you, what is in your future, aside from this year of working on countering violence extremism?
Yeah. CVE.
CVE.
There you go.
Are you thinking long term? Are you with, or is Undisclosed?
Well, the book is, the book on Adnan's case, which like I'm still editing, but we're almost done, is coming out in September.
Oh, beautiful.
And that's gonna.
You got a title yet?
Yep. I mean, that it's been out for it's called Adnan Story.
Okay.
And it, quite frankly, I didn't pick the title, but anyhow, the marketing department of the publishing house does all that fun stuff where they pick the title and pick the book
cover. I mean, they're clearly killing it in the creativity department.
They are. Yeah. It's,
I mean,
I had a different working title that, which I like better, but whatever, it is what it is.
Hey, the book is getting out.
The book is going to be published, and it's coming out in September, St. Martin's Press. So that's on the horizon. I would love to like write, because I, and this is something that I wrote because I felt like I had to write it. And like I had an agent say, look, if you're not going to write it, somebody else is going to write it. Mm. So wouldn't you rather be in control? I'm like, damn it.
Yeah, agents are great like that.
That's smart. Yeah. That's smart though.
It is smart, I guess, but it's been a long, exhausting year with the book, so I'm glad it's almost done.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. I think after this fellowship is done, you know, I'll continue to work on the wrongful conviction stuff, and I might take a few months off, but there's always so much work. I get a lot of consulting work, a lot of contract work, and yeah, I don't know. I would love to write, like, fiction. So I have a couple of novels, like, in the oven.
Amazing.
But, I don't know if anybody will buy them, but we'll see.
Well, we're excited to get to talk about those fiction novels next time we have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, please. Thank you so much for giving us your time and sharing with us so generously.
I hope people don't get bored by like all the hijab and religion
talk. No,
I don't think, I hope they don't. I wasn't, because okay. I don't think that many people really understand the behind it. Like, I think that people just see it and have a very superficial understanding of it. And I think that's why I say the compassion around ignorance is important, because I think that the fear of being shamed in ignorance allows people to only get a superficial understanding of things. And when you really take a deep look at something, it becomes a lot less, one, a lot less scary, two, a lot less ridiculous. It just becomes more human and more relatable. And so if they do, that means that they already know about this. So that's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I have to say, like, that with Serial and Undisclosed, one of the most interesting things that's happened is that as somebody who's done a lot of advocacy, like, around anti-Muslim bigotry and, like, pushing back on stereotypes, and nothing ever worked. But this case, because people now look at me as just somebody who talks about the case, right? Like, not as, like, a Muslim advocate, right? But just somebody who's, like, working on a wrongful conviction. And I've gotten so many emails from people saying, you know, like, we just, exactly what you said. We see a woman in a scarf. We don't know what to think. We're like, well, you know, you just a very superficial understanding. Maybe she's brainwashed. Maybe. Right. And so it's like really humanized. Like, thanks to Serial, it's helped humanize American Muslims. And I think that's pretty remarkable. And so people now email me and say, you know, I'm like a Jewish grandmother and I always was scared of women who were in the scarf. And this is like, you know, I just feel like you're my buddy. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's huge. That's like the kind of ripples that, you know, I believe very strongly in creating space, and I think that when you create space for this kind of stuff, there are strong ripples. So thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for sharing.
Thank you guys for your podcast and what you're doing for us brown folk.
We're trying.
I mean, I'm going to tell you, we have no idea what we're doing, honestly, but we're trying, and we do actually, there is a strong group of people that listen to us, and they do engage, and I do want to take a moment to thank you guys and ask of you one small thing. We've been putting out these Facebook posts, and they have a little question at the bottom of them. You guys have been really great about liking them, which I really appreciate. If you can move your mouse about an inch and a half to the right and share, it would just share on your community, which would then help build our community, which is really the whole point of all of this. You want to
rate the podcast 5 stars on iTunes. I'm so tired of asking you and you not doing it. I feel like I'm a parent of 300 horrible kids, or however many listens we have out there. It's not that many. You're all bums, okay?
I love you guys. Again, we got to start doing it where you do bad cop before I do good cop.
Well, you always clean it up at the end. See what I'm saying?
I feel very threatened. I'm going to get off of here and just get on iTunes.
5 stars. 5 stars. And they're going to ask you to comment.
He's intimidated me into it.
All you got to say, bruh, BRUH, all caps, .. Who's not going to want to listen to that? Yeah. Huh? And the more you see, the more interesting it gets. Like 100 people just said, bro, what's going on here?
Guys, we're going to come back at you with another dope episode next week. So, you know, tune in again. How can they find you? I did this too late. How can they find you on Twitter?
On Twitter, my handle is Rabia Squared.
Perfect.
Yeah. Spell it out, right?
Rabia Squared, Squared.
Yeah, actual.
And is there Undisclosed on Audio Boom, which is also our distributors, and... the book will come out in September. Undisclosed Season 2 coming out in July. Guys, we'll be back next week. Thanks, I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you next then.
God bless.